We have some experts testing. Is this working? There's a red light. I'm just gonna hope that it's working. Yeah. Okay. So basically, what we're gonna do is have our panel give 10 to 15 minute kind of overviews of their experience, and we have Monica Grant, who's going to go first and give us a quick overview of the cycle of the job market and then some of her experience on the job market. And then we have Chelsea Shelley via Skype, whose face you can't see, but you'll hear her voice in a minute. And she is currently an assistant professor at Michigan Technology University, and she's on a search committee. So she can give us that perspective of what maybe employers are looking for from that side. Then we have Alex Hanna. She's been on the market doing so many rolling around Skype interviews and campus visits.
Only one Skype interview that was rolling.
One rolling Skype interview. And then we have David Rangel, who has a job and is going to share that experience with us. And so everyone, feel free to get ready to ask questions. We are recording the session, so don't say anything mean about anyone.
Should we save questions to the end?
Save questions to the end, I think.
Unless it's like really clarifying that you must.
Yes, and we have on Skype also Johanna Quinn and maybe Lily. Lily, are you there? Lily's missing, but maybe she'll arrive. So I'm going to hand it over to you.
Okay, so Katie and Annabelle, I'm Monica Grant. Katie and Annabelle asked me to talk just relatively quickly about sort of giving the lay of the land for what the job market cycle tends to look like. So some of the people here are already on the market and are intimately familiar with the timing of all these things. But for people where the job market might be a little bit further off, it might be more helpful just to go over the timeline for when these things happen. You know? And so you normally think about the first stage of things happening is with the ASA employment cycle. So oftentimes you'll start to have the first job advertisements will be posted around August of the year. Sometimes you'll have some things that are sort of last minute emergency postings in July for schools that need a visiting assistant professor or an adjunct to start that fall. And so there's often something very last minute that pops up right at the end of the summer. But the formal cycle to start a year later tends to start posting positions maybe at the end of July, beginning of August. You'll start to hear some sort of either rumors of what's happening or people will start to post things to the ASA Employment Service. You then, at the American Sociological Association meetings in August, you'll often have many schools will do in-person interviews there, and many of those schools may not have actually even made their formal posting of the job yet, and so it's important that when you log in to look at the ASA Employment Service, it may actually be a much bigger pool than what you think is out there based upon what's actually been posted onto like the ASA job boards or other job sources you're looking at. For the ASA interviews, they tend to be sort of two separate spheres of interviews that are there. There's one that's actually, they actually do an interview kind of clearinghouse where schools can sign up to have a table in a giant gymnasium type of room, and that you'll have 40 tables going at once, and each table will be one search committee interviewing one candidate, and then they ring a bell and your time is up and you either move to another table that you have a scheduled appointment at or you get the heck out of the building. And so it's a very formal process. You submit and it's sort of you request an audience with the search committee that's there, and then they go through either on a first come first serve basis or they try to pick the people they think are most interesting. It tends not to be some of the top R1s at the employment service. It's often smaller liberal arts colleges or regional schools that are trying to get their word out. They're trying almost more in some cases to be trying to convince students who might not often think of this as one of the options that might seem desirable. It's their chance to try to woo you to apply. When I was on the market back as a grad student, I went through the ASA Employment Service, and I think I signed up to have meetings with three or four schools that was there, and it was really helpful for me because you go through those interviews before you've actually submitted any job applications in most cases. And so it's a great chance, regardless of sort of what your sort of you think is going to happen to you on the market, to get a sense of what resonates with the different hiring committees. So what do different types of schools think is interesting about you, to get sort of a practice warm-up run of some loose questions. You can work out your two-minute spiel of talking about your research in a relatively low-key fashion. And many of these schools are sort of, they're very, it's a very positive and a very pleasant experience, I found. It was much less stressful than when you're actually sort of formally on the market and doing Skype interviews or doing phone interviews or even going in person. Then there's the second market that's happening at the ASAs, which is where the top tier schools are also trying to do preliminary interviews with people who might be interviewing, and that they don't often formally advertise these things. And normally the only way that you'll find out about it is from your advisor or from someone word of mouth who knows that the school is going to be hiring. It's also often that sometimes if places are hiring, they'll ask around and see who's on the market and who's good. And so sometimes it's on the basis of like your advisor being connected to other search committees and making a recommendation that you talk to those schools. Sometimes if you hear a rumor that a school is going to be hiring but they haven't posted their advertisement yet, you can sometimes send, if you know someone at that university or your advisor has connections, you can send a query through the grapevine just to have a chat about what might be happening. And those are very low stakes ways for sort of departments just to get a sense of individuals who might be on the market this year, what they might have to offer. And so just as a way to sort of get a sense of sort of who is out there. Most of the application deadlines for sort of the first phase of the market are due basically by October 1st. The first phase of the market tends to be the R1s and a lot of the R2s. And normally by the end of the fall, you'll have the end of the deadlines for sort of more regional schools and institutions. Some of the more prestigious postdocs will have fall deadlines. And then there's like a second wave of the market where applications start to, and sort of job postings roll out in the early springtime. These are often more for visiting assistant professor positions. So where a school knows that they need to hire one person for a year or for 2 years, and they aren't sure that it's going to be able to turn into a tenure track position or not. Maybe they just need someone to fill in for someone who's on a sabbatical for a year to teach their regular course load. And so these, they're short term. There's not necessarily a promise that it's going to turn into a longer term or a tenure track position, and that schools may not even know that these are going to be available until later in the year. You also have other schools that are still sort of there are tenure track jobs that do pop up. So like last week I saw a posting that Western Ontario has three tenure track lines that they're posting, and that this it's a process, it's just, it took a long time for the administration to approve these hires. And so sometimes there's still some good tenure track positions will open up in the spring just because of administrative delays that are going on. You'll also have some sort of postdoc openings that will open up, and sort of the more sort of informal adjuncting and lecture type things will start to get posted throughout the spring for things that are more short-term. If you're looking outside of sociology for jobs, it's very field-specific for what the timeline is. I mean, I'd say, I mean, David knows, like, the ed school jobs are more or less on the sociology timeline. They're a little bit later. So I know some of them often have, like, a November 1st deadline instead of an October 1st deadline. I think schools of public health also run a little bit later in the cycle. So if you're looking outside of sociology departments, you may have a little bit more flexibility around some of the deadlines if the norm for when they hire is tied to whenever their big convention is. You might get some sort of some delayed market activity related to non-sociology departments. I can wrap up. I mean, I don't want to take up all the time. I'm going to hand it off to other people. But I mean, I've had a couple of rounds on the market. I've had experience interviewing at more undergraduate-oriented institutions, as well, obviously, as bigger R1s that are here. I mean, I've had a range of doing Skype interviews, phone interviews, and places that skip that process entirely, and they only bring in people for in-person interviews. So I'm happy that after the other panelists have spoken, I'm happy to answer questions along those lines. But I think we're going to hand it over to Chelsea to talk next. So I've been in the, I mean, I guess in my sixth fear here, I guess. And so, I mean, I've had experience interviewing job candidates, but I've never actually been on a search committee before, so that I haven't been involved in that initial screening process. So hopefully Chelsea can give us some insights into that side of the story and sort of what search committees might be looking for and sort of what the different perspectives that schools are looking at.
Yeah. So, Chelsea, do you want to introduce yourself?
Sure. So, hi, I'm Chelsea, and I graduated in 2013 and started working here at Michigan Technological University, which is in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. So, my experience is a little bit different because I work in a social sciences department. It's an interdisciplinary department. We're held together by the empirical focus of our graduate programs. So, we have a graduate program in environmental and energy policy and a graduate program in industrial heritage and archaeology, but it's an interdisciplinary department. So, it's different probably than a lot of strictly sociology programs. This was the only place that I did an interview, so I don't have a lot of experience from my own perspective, but I have now been on a search committee, so can talk a little bit about that. Our search committee process mirrors the cycle that was just talked about. The applications were due in November, and I think the first thing that I noticed was that the language of the job ad mattered a lot to the people in the department, and it was very, very carefully crafted. And the most successful initial applicants were people who were able to reflect that language back in their letters of interest. So in our case, we were looking specifically for somebody who does energy policy, and talking about climate change just like didn't quite get people there. So it was really important that people be clear that they saw themselves as fitting the specifics of the job ad and the language of that job ad being really important. We did do Skype interviews with candidates, and I've seen it done both ways here, that that questions have been provided for candidates beforehand or not. In the case of the search committee I was on, we did provide those Skype questions beforehand. So in some ways that Skype interview was how much did somebody prepare for answering those questions, and then giving some space for people to ask questions of the program as well. And I think that's another thing that I noticed, was that the candidates that seemed most interesting to us as a search committee were the candidates who had done enough research to actually have some questions to ask about the department or the university or the location, and who were able to sort of turn it back around and learn more about us as well as us learning more about them. Then from the candidates that we brought in for that position, I would say that, I mean, job talks are clearly very, very important, but I don't know, and again, because I work in an interdisciplinary department, I don't know if this is unique, but the things that seemed most important for us might not be what you would expect. So for us, the thing that really became clearly most important was not like how interesting is somebody's research or how conceptually sophisticated are they or empirically sophisticated, again, because we're in an interdisciplinary department, we don't really sort of judge the caliber of one another's work on disciplinary grounds, but really, are you able to formulate a clear research question and demonstrate that you've successfully answered it? It's really more of a general, can you be a researcher, an independent and productive researcher, than like how interesting is your specific question. So the successful candidates were those who were able to put their job talks in the frame of like being a good researcher and being able to craft interesting questions independently of funding resources or advisors or those sorts of things, where you're going to be able to be a good scholar sort of outside of the context of graduate school. And then also the best both job talks and one-on-one interactions were those where the candidates were able to sort of place themselves in the context of our department. So good job talks, from my perspective, end with, and if I were here and knowing what I do about the department culture, here's where I see myself extending my work or moving forward, kind of to fit what the interests are of that department or that program, and to fit the whatever the regional context is and the issues that are interesting given that particular context. So if you haven't thought through sort of how your research might be shaped by both the institutional context and the social context in which you would be working, I think that that's an indication that you haven't really prepared for realistically thinking about what it would be like to work in that place. One of the other things that we do as a search committee is to organize meetings with faculty across campus or institutions, research groups that the candidate might be interested in. And my experience is that those conversations are actually, at this institution, more important than the conversation sort of higher up the administrative hierarchy, like the meeting with the dean that you'll have when you go to a campus visit. Being able to identify people across campus or particular research institutes on a campus that you can plug into and that interest you, and like having good meetings and good conversations with people was important for us in trying to identify people who would be successful here. And then I guess the last thing that I can think of is, and again, maybe this is unique for our context living where we are. It's certainly true across universities, right, that it's illegal for them to ask you questions about you as a person, you sort of outside of your academic identity, your family, or your interests, those sorts of things. But if you can provide enough information to make it clear that you will be a happy human in that environment and not just a scholar, I think that that is helpful as again, maybe specifically to this context, but I work with people who want people to be happy, whole humans, and so knowing that you can live with 200 inches of snow like we do because you really enjoy snowshoeing, or knowing that you have thought about what kinds of community connections you might make because you know something about what's happening in the community, they're not things that we can ask about, but they're things that seriously interested candidates are able to communicate about in an effective way. So those are some of my thoughts, and I'm happy to take questions.
Awesome. Thank you.
So first we're going to, who wants to go first, David? Alex? Alex, David.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
We're going to hear from Alex. Thanks. Will you please introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm Alex Hannah. I am a seventh year student in this department, and this year is my second time on the market. I have cumulatively done, I think, 8 visits, and mostly at R1 schools, mostly not in sociology, mostly in communication studies and associated programs. And so talking a few things, timeline is going to be a little different, as Monica said, between different fields. Sociology in political science tend to be earlier, communications and associated jobs, information schools are a little later. Jobs will also possibly reopen up if they weren't able to find a candidate in February or March. I recently had a search chair email me and tell me to reapply for a political science department. And so this is possible if their first choices don't pan out. In terms of, in terms of just the time that you're going to spend on the market, a lot of it is just is this preparation time in terms of researching the school, researching the faculty, the initiatives, the courses that that are on file. And finding out how you can present yourself to fit within that framework. So if you have contacts at the school, reaching out to them and asking what this position is envisioned as, what kind of things are valued there, is a very big deal. So that takes a lot of time, and it takes a lot of time to do that, and to do that well, and to prepare your materials to signal that you are expressing the values of the school. There's also, I mean, the other time is also dedicated to polishing your market papers you're sending out, and the talk itself that you're giving, and making sure that talk is going to appeal to the particular audience that you are speaking with. So I'm not going to use the same kind of talk for a sociology or political science department than I would with a communications department. The same with cover letters. It needs to signal what are priorities in those sub-disciplines. Political science is a much more balkanized kind of discipline within you know, the five main things, whereas sociology has many more subdisciplines. In terms of interviewing, there is the process of Skype interviews, which in which they're usually asking people the same set of questions, and all of these, so it may seem a little bit rote, but they do this pretty methodically. You should prepare for a Skype interview like any other kind of interview, and put in the same kind of work and do the research and background on all the faculty and the search committee. It's okay to ask who the search committee is and to obtain a detailed profile on the search committee. I have read like the search committee's one of their articles or more recent work. I ended up reading one of a committee member's book because I just did for a recent visit. It was a good book, so it was worth it. But it's also by getting a sense of what the research priorities and scholarly priorities of the people are is important. In terms of job visits, so being on 8 job visits over the past 2 years, it's an exhausting process. Because as soon as you land, or if you get picked up by somebody, you are on, and they are evaluating you as a candidate and as a future colleague and someone that you're wondering, how can I get along with this person for the next at least 6 to 7 years? And so because of that, it's a lot of these things are, you know, thinking a lot, putting a lot of mental and emotional energy into how you are presenting and what you say, and a lot of that is part of it. On the typical job visit, you will meet anywhere from 4 to 15 people. You can meet with a lot of people in a given day or two. Usually there are 2 days. I've had job visits that have gone to 3 days, including going to a department holiday party. So you have to be pretty flexible and expect the unexpected here, and be ready for that and be able to kind of present yourself as a great future colleague and someone who does very interesting work and is interested in what other people are doing in the department. Aside from just the visits, there's the job talk, which, as the professor is in, tends to call it the crowning jewel of the visit. And she says, if you can't bomb the job talk and still get the job, so that is something. Along, you can also have a teaching talk that is very typical, and you will speak to the dean. Usually, the dean will have less of an influence in the decision, but will talk to you and inform you about research funds and the kind of TNP stuff, tenure and promotion. Those are also good things to ask about. What else? There's also meetings with graduate students, and these can be kind of a very type of experience. Some meetings with graduate students, graduate student feedback can be valued. Some of it is not. It's just kind of depends on the variability. I don't know how Wisconsin tends to value graduate. You don't have the chance.
You're outnumbered.
Yeah. But it's you know, just hanging out with grad students can be part of it. I can tell you about a very good experience in the job market. I can tell you about a very terrible experience in the job market. We can just save that for Q&A. But it is a very taxing experience both before and after, during and after. After, the taxing comes from the waiting. Mm. And like, I'm currently in that position right now where you're just waiting for a call and you can't really do much other than wait. And it's a very it's very anxiety provoking. I actually just received a call today for the interview that I did online, and they said that they want to fly me out just to hang out for like a day. No. Which
did you meet your person before
you make it off? Yeah, it's a positive sign, but it's also like, God, when will this freaking end?
Yeah.
And so it's that may be, aside from doing all the prep, maybe one of the most trying periods of the market that I find is kind of the uncertainty of it all.
Yeah.
And you shouldn't expect to get a lot of research done, original research done, when you're on the market, because it takes a lot of time and it takes a lot of physical, emotional, intellectual energy. So be prepared for that. I'll leave it there and I'll let David take it.
Awesome. Can someone pass this recorder down to that end?
Hi. So I'm David Rangel. I'm, I guess, finishing up my seventh year. So I recently accepted a position, a tenure track faculty position at Brown University, and their Department of Education. And so, Katie sent along a list of questions that she wanted us to kind of get the discussion going. But I just want to truncate that. Kind of my comments are going to reflect being on the market and not things that you need to do to prepare, like in advance for the market, how to determine whether or not you're ready for the market, what you should do like in advance so what I'm going to talk about primarily is like the interviewing process and what that kind of things. So there's a lot of prep work that goes into like before you hit your ASA employment service, and if you decide to meet with faculty informally or you do the employment service, there's a lot of stuff that should be happening before that time. And I'm just going to truncate that because that's a whole other discussion and a lot longer discussion, or maybe just as long. So I'm just going to talk about the actual employment service, what that was like, my interviews there, my Skype and telephone interviews, and my on-campus visits. So I applied to basically any school that fit a broad criteria. There were schools that were looking for education, schools that were looking for race ethnicity, schools that were looking for human development. And so I applied to both sociology schools, I applied to departments of education, and I also applied to one human development and family studies school also. And so I applied to 36 different places. And of those, 28 were in sociology. And so I applied in sociology schools to R1, major research institutions. I applied to R2 schools, which are schools that don't have like a PhD program or might have masters. I mean, I also applied to liberal arts colleges as well. And I also applied to non-academic positions. My goal was to get a job, and I really didn't care where the job was going to be. And so I was just focused on making sure, which meant that when I was on the market, that every single one of my letters had to be customized for the different department, for the different positions, for the different schools, for the different students that they serve. I mean, so everything was very much customized to each institution that I was applying to, whether they privileged research, whether they privileged teaching, the demographics of the students, whether they had large majority-minority populations or whether they didn't. So all those things were basically customized that were going into what my applications look like, which is why the job market is a huge time sink, right? And so if you're doing all this customization for, you know, I did it for 36 different applications. I mean, it just time just falls away. You're like, where did it all go? And there are jobs that I was eligible for that I should have applied to, but I missed just because, I mean, I'm not as organized as I should be, and so time, you know, schools I didn't apply to just because I didn't have the time to. So I had flyouts at a liberal arts college for sociology. I was had a flyout to two different schools of ed, and then I also had both R1s, and then I also had been invited to another R1 job talk, and had been invited to a non-academic, so I applied to RAND, which is a policy research organization, and so I had been invited to present there. And so my interview with RAND and my interview with I interviewed at Loyola Marymount, which is a select liberal arts university. Both of those campus visit invites were based off my employment service interviews, right? So I had no other previous contact with these institutions other than meeting with them at RAND, right? And so, of course, I applied for the job once the job came out, but I didn't do a Skype interview and I had no follow-up phone interview. So essentially, my interview with these institutions took place there at ASA, right? And so it was off of my interviews that I got a flyout from these two, from at least from RAND and from Loyola Marymount. And so, so as Monica was saying, that, you know, you're not going to have a lot of major R1 that are going through the employment service, but you can still get invites, campus visits from doing really well at these at the employment service. And so, usually on SoScribeChat, you'll see a person every year being like, "Should I pay for the employment service? Is it worth it?" It's like $75. If you have a really great advisor, your advisor will pay for you. If you don't have a great advisor, I'm shaming every single advisor that doesn't pay for their student to go on the market. No, I mean, even if they take it out of their own pocket, I mean, it's not like every advisor has like 5 or 10 students going on the market, but, you know, they can afford $75 more so than maybe graduate students that are TAing, that are even worse financial constraints. So, but yeah, so if you can, so I think going to the employment service is good for a number of reasons. One, because it can result in flyouts. Two, because it prepares you to present your research in a very succinct fashion, right? And so I had the benefit of having a master's before starting the program. And so when I was asking faculty here about what the employment service interview process was like, there wasn't a lot of help. There wasn't, I mean, my advisor, they were like, you know, I can't really tell you much about it, don't have much experience with it. You know, I don't know much about it. So I had to rely on my master's institution, which does a lot of interviews at ASA through the employment service. And so I got my former advisors to do a mock interview with me where there's a gong, like there's actually a bell to tell you when to start. There's a gong that goes off when there's like 2 minutes left, and then, you know, there's another bell that says you're done. Yeah. And so I had the fortune of having, you know, I haven't seen any people that set anything up here. It might be a good idea, like going forward, to have simulated mock 20-minute ASA employment service interviews, where you get the opportunity to talk about your research or have people fire questions at you. And so that, I mean, literally, my mock interview was the most helpful, because it was the most helpful portion of my job hunting process. Because every interview, whether it be Skype or phone interview, was basically 20 or 30 minutes. And so it was a recreation of what was going on at this employment service, right? And so being really really well prepared, you know, having your... So one of the questions that Katie asked was like, what are weird questions? And so the weird questions that I mostly got were those during my employment service. One of them, so Rand asked me in 2 sentences, tell me about your dissertation.
Oh my God.
But that's
easy.
You actually prepared for that.
Yeah.
That's not that weird.
Yeah, I mean, so
but in 2 sentences.
In 2 sentences, right?
But you should aim for that. You should.
Yeah. That should be the goal for everything.
And then I also had a question that was, it was for an urban job, and the question was, when I say the words urban and theory, what comes to mind?
That's harder. I had somebody that was like, describe your scholarly profile in 2 words. Okay, not 2 sentences.
You just say badass.
No, I think I said something like, I forgot what I said.
So the point is that the employment services is really helpful in terms of being able to get in touch with other departments so that you can learn really about how to communicate yourself to other people in a succinct fashion. And also, that you can get a sense of like the kind of questions that you can be expected to be asked when you are doing a phone interview or you are doing a Skype interview, because the questions across the board, whether it was at employment service, Skype interview, or telephone interview, were all basically the same. I mean, there was very little variation in terms of it. I think Katie sent out an attachment that had kind of how to prepare for interviews and what they're like. So the questions that they had on there are pretty similar, where it's like, you know, tell me about your dissertation or your research. Tell me about the contributions that your dissertation is making, right? And so again, you need to have like 1 or 2 sentences about why your research is important and what it's talking about. Why do you want to work here? So why Loyola Marymount University, right? And so for each institution that you're talking with, I was really bad about preparing for this question, And it was the one that tripped me up most times, even though it seemed like it should be a very standard question. So just making sure you have a very well-articulated rationale for why that place is a good for you and why you want to go there. And especially if there's like a disconnect between like, oh, you're coming from Wisconsin and maybe you have a publication or two and you're applying to this select liberal arts college that has no research and is primarily focused on teaching. Like, your whole scholarly career suggests that you're on a trajectory that prepares you for a specific kind of job, and now you're at an institution where the expectations are not related or disconnected from where your trajectory shows you're at, right? So so the job market is really about making the connection between what you're doing and why you're doing is related to that job that you're trying to get. And it's really important that you make a strong case. Like Chelsea was talking about, why that institution, why you're applying at an institution, and why you can excel at that institution, particularly when your trajectory might not match what they might expect, or the normal, quote unquote, normal people that might start at these institutions. A common question that you can be guaranteed to ask is, what classes do you want to teach? So you need to have well-formulated ideas about the classes that you'd like to teach. For employment service, you just need to have classes either that you've taught before or classes that you can think about. You don't need to do advanced work on, I know this class is missing at your department, like it's not as critical. When it's the Skype interview or when you're having a phone interview, it's much more critical that you know what the course offerings are and what classes that you would like to teach and how that fits in with what the institution already offers. So at research institutions, I often got asked where I intended to publish my research, what journals I was looking at, and where I thought my work could go. And again, for research positions, they're wanting to know, how well of a fit in terms of your research that is it going to be with what's going on. At teaching institutions, they might ask about your approach to teaching, your experience working with undergraduate students. And so, just make sure you have a 1 or 2 minute spiel about your teaching experience, about your teaching philosophy. I've never taught a class, and so I had to, especially at liberal arts institutions, kind of make the case about why not having taught classes wouldn't be a detriment, and why I was still interested in being a liberal arts institution. And so, it's whether you have a lot of, whether you have a lot of teaching experience or no teaching experience, you still have to make the case and you have to make that sale. And so don't expect that if you have a lot of teaching experience, that it often automatically qualifies you for teaching positions, right? It's like, especially at a place where Wisconsin, where, people aren't TAs because they necessarily want to be TAs and because they enjoy teaching, And so there's a strong case to be made that just because you're a TA doesn't mean that you enjoy teaching, right? And so, so you always have to make the case. Don't expect your experience to speak for itself. They always asked about, at least at R1s, they asked about your future research plans. And so Chelsea, again, talked a little bit about this. So what are your post-dissertation projects? Right? How well formulated are those? Like, are you going to be able to hit the ground running, or all you have is your dissertation, and you had the help of your advisor help you craft your research questions, your ideas, and your methods? And so, what is in the works? What do you have going? And so, it needs to be well planned and thought out, but doesn't have to have any execution associated with it. But you have to at least have two different research projects. At least one. But two is even better, about what your trajectory is going to be like going forward. What are the central questions that you're really interested in addressing in your future research? And so oftentimes, especially at the dissertation stage, we're just focused on getting that done. And as Alex said, you don't have time for original research. You don't have time to do anything but write applications. But kind of formulating what those future research questions are going to be is really important, because you're also going to go on your cover letter about what the next steps are too. And so you need to be able to articulate where your next pivot is, what the next project that's going to come out, and not after, after all your dissertation chapters are going to be published, because the assumption is that all of them are going to be great and they're all going to get published, at least at R1s. And so, and then they always ask, do you have any questions for us? right? And so I didn't want to, that was one question that I didn't want to worry about catering for each institution. So all I asked each institution is, what is the biggest challenge facing your department? Right, and so it made it seem like, oh, it's an individual question to this institution, but I didn't have to do any research on the school. Didn't have to think about, like, it was just one less thing that I had to worry about, and by and large, people have said, oh, that's a really good question, right? And so it makes it seem like, oh, you're really thoughtful, that you thought really hard about this question, but all you need, but asking, you know, what is the biggest challenge facing your department? And so often that gets them talking, and then it allows you to ask a follow-up question based on what their response is. And if there's no like segue, then you can ask, well, what do you think the biggest strength of the department is, right? You know, so like again, it's about thinking about fit and how you're going to fit in, and kind of how they're pitching and how they're selling their institution. So I think those are really good standard research questions that if you don't want to do a lot of work and you're really worried about making sure that you know, and that's usually at the close of the interview, right? So the very last things that you're going to leave them with is the kind of questions that you ask them. So being really insightful or asking a good question is I think really important. Let's see. So the campus portion of the interviews, as Alex was talking about, it's nonstop meetings. As somebody described it to me, it said you might be meeting 500 people, but it's every time you meet somebody, it's the first time that they're meeting you, and so it's really important to kind of really be energetic and enthusiastic and excited instead of being really affable and friendly is really important for each meeting that you have, even though it becomes to be really tiring as it goes on. So I was expecting during these personal meetings to ask a lot of questions to the faculty, but by and large it was them asking me like a ton of questions. It was like it was like Groundhog's Day, where each individual faculty was asking you the same question over and over again. So trying to stay high energy when you're having the same, it's like Groundhog's Day, where everybody's asking the same question over and over again, it's kind of challenging. So the campus visits, it's a beast in itself, but it's really about presenting, having a really succinct job talk, making sure the job talk fits with the institutions, making sure that the questions that you ask are appropriate for the institution that you're at. So when I was at Loyola Marymount, the campus portion was fine, but I asked a lot of questions about research. And so I think, one of the reasons why they decided to not offer me the job, aside from having a really terrible teaching demo, was not saying about why doing research was really important for me, right? So I didn't connect it to say like, look, I believe in educational inequality, and inequality is about pipeline. And so engaging students in research, me doing my research and engaging students in that research, is a way that you can address educational inequality, right? I think had I said that one line, it would have made a much more broader impact about why I was asking at a liberal arts college about research. Right, so just make sure that your questions are appropriate for the institution that you're applying for. And then things that I wished I'd known. So I'm still waiting to get reimbursed from November and October from two institutions. Yeah. So be prepared to be out of pocket with some funds. Some places are really good about giving you reimbursement really quickly, and other places obviously are really bad about giving you reimbursement really quickly.
Some places, the gold standard is to have a place book your travel for you.
Because then you don't have to.
Right.
Have a pocket.
Right. So, some places will, they'll make the arrangements for the plane ticket. You give them your general availability, your preferences, and then they'll book the ticket. They'll pay for it. You don't have to worry about paying out of pocket. But more schools than you would like will ask you to pay for your plane ticket and then reimburse you for it.
Yeah. Just find if they're somewhat expedient about
Yes.
But a lot of them aren't.
Some of them
probably.
Are. Yeah. I had Ohio State reimburse me the next week. I was they had an online thing. It was
It was like 3 days at Brown. It was great.
Yeah,
but other places, I'm still waiting.
School or public private. It's just
depends on their system.
Yeah,
which some are not very friendly towards.
So it might be worth getting the bus down to Chicago.
Just be prepared that your credit cards are going to take a dent.
Yeah, you can expect to spend, probably around, if you're not calculating reimbursables, like things that you probably won't get reimbursed on, at least $500. That's like using Interfolio and doing clothing and cleaning and that, including reimbursables, and it can get high.
And all this is within the guise of like you're still applying the other jobs, you're getting rejected along the way. You know, so, you know, rejection is the name of the game, right? Mm-hmm. Most people are going to be rejected a ton of times more often than they're going to be accepted. And so, you know, it's taxing, it's emotionally draining, it's physically draining because of the amount of time. I mean, it's
financially
draining. Like, it gets you good, and it gets you everywhere really hard.
Yeah.
And it's also really isolating because part of it is that you have other people that are on the market too, right? So it's like you understand people are being really frustrated, whether it's like their first time, the second time, often third time they may be on the market, right? I mean, it's a tough job market. And so, you know, it's like you don't want to, you know, rub it in people's faces that you got this great offer or whatever. It's like, you know, so it's like you often experience a lot of these things in you know, a very small group or small knit, or with me, it was just like my wife and I kind of, I was telling her about everything and stuff, and that was kind of it, so.
Sometimes you're competing with your friends. I interviewed at least, or it was a competition with a friend of mine, for at least two jobs.
Yeah.
He ended up getting one of the jobs.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, especially at the employment service, I was getting up, and then one of the persons from my cohort was sitting down at the next person to interview, mm-hmm. right?
That's also what makes it somewhat isolating, is I feel like even though people know what's going on, there's not necessarily a lot of sharing mm-hmm. about, like, this sucks. And people who aren't on the market, like, while they get it, they don't really get it.
Right.
So, and you feel like you're constantly complaining about it.
They're right. Like, how are you? Oh, it's so exciting. You have so many opportunities. You're like,
you're like, I am tired and stressed and have no money. It is not exciting.
Yeah.
Right? So you also limit talking about it because you don't want to be seen as like constantly negative.
So it's helpful to sympathize with someone else who's going through it.
Right.
You might be. I still talk a lot with the guy who eventually got the job. Because we talk about a lot of stuff. But other people just in your field of work are also, because they're just like, just events, and it's mutual venting.
Yeah. But you also don't want to be the first one to ask. Be like, oh, how, like, if you share that information, people will ask you questions, but if you don't share, people are often reluctant to initiate, being mm-hmm. like, how's it going? But,
yeah. Also talk to your therapist.
Yeah.
Are we at question time?
Yeah.
I'm wondering, for your own like dissertation writing and original research, how much had you had done before you started the job market, and like what should is it like it just completely stopped, and if so, for how many months, just to like plan ahead?
Yeah, months. I mean, for some applications, I was like, oh, I know how to do these results, and I would like stay up for a week just trying to make the paper better and put in some new results. But that's the last time I've worked on my dissertation. I actually haven't started working on original analysis for my dissertation until this week, since like August.
Okay.
Where the last time I made changes to that chapter was September. As for how much I had done, like half a chapter.
Total.
Total.
But that's a dangerous strategy, though, because when I was in the market, I lost 3-4 months, like just completely on nothing. Just either
like the fall semester is like
right.
really
and so,
hard.
And
to
even
get
after like all the deadlines have passed, your applications are all submitted. Just the emotional energy that goes into waiting to hear, are you going to get an interview? If you get an interview, that waiting. Until you
have to
results.
Prepare a job talk that you might not have, right?
Like, you often only have perhaps 2 weeks in advance of the invitation to going in. So maybe 2 weeks, maybe less than 2 weeks time. And so you actually need to have something that you could have as a talk prepared
right.
somewhat in advance. But then, like, often when I had 7 interviews the year I was on the market, and several of them, like, you would get an email, like, maybe a week or two before I got an invitation to
like come to campus, I would get an email asking me to send two dissertation chapters in addition to the writing samples that I had originally sent, so that schools would put a premium on making sure that they have some schools that they want to be confident you're actually going to finish by the end of the summer and you're going to show up with a dissert, put the PhD in hand, and so they want you to actually be able to send them dissertation chapters in November proving that you've made X amount of progress. And so, I mean, it's really deemed risky to send them on the market with less than that. But so, I mean, I had that happen several times where people would ask me to send, I mean, those were at the higher level, like R1s that I was applying to. They would ask for additional, like when I applied here, I had, they asked for additional writing samples right before, like a month before I got the interview. When I interviewed at Princeton, they asked for like dissertation chapters. And so like for that one, it really was me like scrambling in 2 days to like polish out like a chapter, like the second chapter, because I was writing a 3-chapter dissertation, and luckily I had like text for 2 out of the 3, and I was doing the analysis for the third at the point where I was starting to be on the market. And so I had to like frantically polish that second chapter to make sure that I had 2 chapters that were in good enough condition to send to them. So it's a risky strategy to go on without having at least some text to share.
I think that you, just from like the application part, like you should have at least one, hopefully, unless you have like publications from other things, really good publications, like you should have at least one chapter done, and hopefully like at least an R&R stage, so that when they ask for a writing sample, most of the things, I applied for a lot of positions, and most of them asked for at least one writing sample. Some of them asked for 2, some of them asked for 3, but most of them asked for at least one. And you want to be able to send something that's about your dissertation.
Sure.
And so, like, I agree that it's impossible. I mean, it's very difficult to get anything done from July, basically, until, like, About now.
Yeah.
And, like, unless you have something. So I had an R&R, so I was able to, like, turn around the R&R during that time, but I haven't really been able to. I've done a little bit of work. Like, you'll have a week, and you'll be like, all right, this week, I'm just going to do this one thing.
Right.
But it's not that you don't have any time at all. It's that you're so distracted and distraught and tired that the thought of, like, starting up your research again, like, it takes you 2 days to get into it, and then you have 2 days. And then you get a call saying, you have an interview.
Right. The only work I've been doing is, like, the kind of,
like,
maintenance work
on the patch.
On the grant that we're on.
And Gina and I actually have their hands up.
So, I actually have 2 small questions. And the first one is that when they ask for a writing sample, so one of my dissertation chapters is I sent out for publication. So let's say it gets published. Is that cool to be a writing sample?
Yes.
They want
an article.
Scenario.
Some of them actually say, like, not even writing samples, they say publications. And you're like,
yeah.
Okay. And then the second question is, thank you very much. And then the second question is, I'm only used to applying to non-academic jobs since that was my life before I came here. And it was customary to follow up with, like, a thank you so much for having me, so kind of thing. Do you do that the same way you would in a non-academic job, or is it, and then also, I guess, if you don't hear anything, is it customary that, like, they'll just leave you hanging forever?
Yep.
Even if they have you fly out?
Yep. I heard someplace I hadn't heard from, I applied for last year, and they interviewed me this year.
Yeah.
And it's, so it may not be that they've rejected you. It may be that they don't have their shit together, you know. And
but
just
most of them, if you don't hear anything, and you look on the rumor boards, and they're like, they've hired someone.
Yeah.
I've gotten a lot of rejections, but there's a lot of schools that I know have hired people in positions that I've applied for, and I haven't heard anything from them.
Mm-hmm. Sure. I mean, I think that when places tend to be a little bit more forthcoming with information if you've had an on-campus interview. And then oftentimes they will, at the time of the interview, it's entirely within your rights to sort of ask. One question to always ask is about timelines for people. And so particularly when you're talking to the search committee or with the chair of the department, to ask sort of what time frame they're going to be operating in. So if they know already, like, do they have a date? Some places will already know the exact date they're going to vote. And then they'll say, like, it'll be another week or so to get through administrative approvals, and so we won't be able to tell anybody anything for 4 weeks from now. And then if 4 weeks come and go, you have it, but you don't hear anything from them. That's a good point. That then, if you know, you can either send them a message, just send an update. It might be a signal that maybe you weren't their first choice, but you're definitely not their last choice. Mm-hmm. And so that they're waiting until the person that they offer the job to turns them down or accepts them, and you're clearly still in contention because they haven't given you a result yet. Mm-hmm. And so because you just never, and sometimes that gets. Goes on forever, right? I was on the market the year that the market collapsed. Gosh. So back in the year of the recession, and so half the jobs I had a wealth of riches of having 7 on-campus interviews, and half of them were frozen. After they had people come out on campus, the dean basically sort of like put a freeze on all hiring, and so they weren't even sort of, they didn't even vote until, if they voted, it was months after the interviews took place that they actually made decisions. And so sometimes it's not even that you're not the person that they want. You might be the person that they want, but they've actually sort of administratively something is holding up the process. So one of the offers that I got when I was on the market was one that I interviewed in November, and they gave me an offer in February. Mm-hmm. And I was their first choice for the job, but it was such a protracted process until they actually had approval to make an offer. So sometimes it has nothing to do with where you are in their list of preferences. Mm-hmm. It's everything to do with sort of other administrative things that are going on as well.
One thing to do is to become friends with the administrative assistant, mm-hmm. the office person who, like, I've done this as a PA. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, honestly, it's that the people who are hiring, it's gone to their back burner, and they forget that they need to, like, convene the committee, and I'm not lying. So if you can be like, hey, Katie, you were so nice when I was there. Can you just tell me, like, you know, what's going on? And then Katie will be like, hey, Dr. Wilson, you really need to. Wait, I chose next, and then you can.
There's another question about the thank you letter. Yes.
Is that? Go ahead.
I've heard both.
I've heard mixed things.
I don't know whether to,
because some people say they see it as pushy.
I like it when people do it.
And even after Skype, I send emails. Mm-hmm.
I like receiving them.
After every
you do. What would you say? Just that it was a pleasure to meet you. Yeah. If you have any like follow up questions,
thank you for taking the time to meet with me.
Listening about my research, I was really excited to talk to you.
Like particularly if there's something we connected on, I might repeat that. I don't always remember to do it with. If I haven't sent it within like the first like 3 days, then I don't.
Then it's just weird. They want to know, but they don't just ask me.
Right. So I normally give it like a 24-hour waiting period. So after I'm back home, I'm not like at the airport sending like thank you notes that night. But like, I mean, if I have the time to do it, I think that's a nice.
Even after Skype interviews. Is where
like, I did it every time. I just stand in practice. So like, look, thanks for taking the time to speak to me. I really appreciate it.
It's an email, right?
Faculty
thing. All email.
Particularly if you're careful, if you frame it so that it doesn't look like.
I was there, and the woman was like, I hate it when people send thank you.
Particularly make it so it doesn't look like you're fishing for details.
Well, that's what if you send it like within whatever.
I mean, try to make it like. I enjoy meeting you. Say thank you. Like I enjoy talking about this with you.
If you have any clarifying questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Right, but like don't.
I just say thank you for your time. I really appreciated the opportunity to speak with you today and tell you a little bit about myself.
Yeah, sometimes they can. Like I sent one for someone I met with at like Iowa, and then we started talking about this research thing that she was interested in, and we had a few exchanges, and that was interesting. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it increased my chances, but it's fine. It's just like an interesting exchange. But
I wonder if that the woman at the interview thing that we went to, just maybe you can gauge from the, I'm not sure how much you can gauge in an interview, but maybe she would be the sort of person who'd be like, she doesn't seem like she'd really want to receive any. I don't know.
Maybe.
It's hard to get. But it could also be like science versus like she was a hard science.
She was a hard scientist.
No, she was the English.
She was English.
She was a panel discussion.
She was just a curmudgeon.
And she was like,
so we only have a little bit of time left. And Aisha has a question. She's been waiting. And then Matt.
Yeah, I just thought about the writing samples, actually. So two questions. One was short to just follow up on Annabelle said. So you're saying that they require a minimum one writing sample?
Yes.
preferably a publication. If not, I suppose it's going to be a dissertation chapter, and then they can ask you for other writing samples.
Some of them require like more at the time of submission.
If you have a three-chapter dissertation, and let's say you haven't published any of those chapters yet, and you send those three writing samples, and they ask for more, what are you supposed to
do? They're not going to ask for more than three. Yeah.
So that's the thing.
Especially if those are the three dissertation chapters. They're just not.
We ask.
Yeah.
We ask.
Well, they can ask, but if you have a
working
if you have something else,
other projects going on besides your dissertation,
or if you have an article from before your dissertation,
right?
Yeah, I used the. I didn't have a chapter of my dissertation. I don't have a chapter of my dissertation. Close yours, Monica.
Yeah,
I know.
So it's very unusual. So I used. I have papers that are. So one paper I had that uses a writing sample got an ASA paper award, but it's also co-authored. But I was listed as first author. I haven't published it yet, so I use that as a writing sample. And then I have another co-authored paper that isn't published, but is like almost ready to go out for draft. That's that I use for my writing samples too. And then I have a publication out that I'm like third author that I would send that as another writing sample. And I have something else that's under review. Again, none of this is for my dissertation, right? So I had papers that if they were so the dreaded question was like I kept on.
But does it have
hoping,
to do
hoping
with
praying,
like the topic of your dissertation, kind of?
They weren't related. They use the same data.
Well, then yes.
They use the same data,
right?
But yeah, I mean, so I was hoping and praying that nobody would ask me for a dissertation chapter.
I had a chapter. So the paper I have published, I have like a published paper that has an ASA award, but then it doesn't really have anything to do with my dissertation. And so if they were just asking for one, I would not send that out. I would send out kind of the working copy of the dissertation chapter. And then that would probably be my second priority, depending on the school. And then I have a second author paper that's co-authored with like five other people, but that would send that out as well. And for social jobs, usually the ASA one, for communications jobs, more the one that's more communication-centric. So just trying to gauge.
I mean, and importantly, you have to articulate. So I didn't have one chapter, but when people asked me about my dissertation, I said, my dissertation does three different things. In my first chapter, I do this. In my second chapter, I do this. In my third chapter, I do this.
Yeah.
And then I have my research findings suggest this, right? Mm-hmm. So even though I didn't have a dissertation chapter that I was sending out, like in my head, I had this. I had each individual chapter written. I had the research question that I was interested in, and I had preliminary results that suggested I was much further along with my dissertation than not having a chapter drafted.
Can I ask, when you send in co-authored pieces, when you send those in, do you have to describe what your contribution to the paper was?
Nobody asked what contribution to do.
How do they know then? I mean, of course you're first author on one, but if you're like down the line a little bit, you know, I mean, how do they know you didn't write a footnote and that was it? They don't ask, really?
That's the problem with co-authorship, the process.
Philosophy here, and I would actually counter that very much, though. We had a lot of issues with people sending in co-authored papers, either as writing samples or in looking over their CVs. We're very, very skeptical of people who only have co-authored papers in terms of ability to create independent research. So, and we do our writing sample, our publications. That's what we ask for, is one to three publications. So people weren't sending in dissertation chapters that weren't published or submitted for review at all. So I don't know that that would be true everywhere, that they don't think about co-authored papers as anything different. In the case where people were either Skyped or brought to campus, we explicitly ask them about what's their contribution to any co-authored paper that we see on their CV.
And my sense is
probably different in different places.
We might be saying the same thing. Maybe. My sense is this is very disciplinary. That the different disciplines treat this differently. Mm-hmm. Because in communication, having a five or six person paper is regular.
Okay.
And one place I interviewed has a lab structure. Uh-huh. That's the lab, and having everybody in the lab on the paper is common practice.
But I think that there's across disciplines, though, that the order of authorship matters, and that differences by discipline in terms of where you are in the order matters, right? So in public health, being the last person listed is very prestigious. In sociology, being the last person, it means that you've done very little on the paper. And so different disciplines and depending on the venue you've published in, it's going to make a difference, and you may want to provide some interpretation. But, I mean, my sense is that anything that's not first authored is going to automatically be sort of not discredited per se, but it's going to show that it's not providing, if you haven't, if you're only giving co-authored publications and you're not giving, and you're not either the first author on all of them or you have a single authored publication to go along with it, it's hard for them to have a sense of what your voice is. And that's the real concern, I think, particularly for sociology, is that if you're the first author and you have three or four authors behind you, there's an assumption, though, that it's your voice that has stitched everything together. Mm. But if you're the second or the third author, it's less clear what your contribution and your leadership is. And so that if you have a co-authored paper and you have a single author paper to go along with it, they can at least make some inferences, right, that from this single author paper, they know the tone of your writing. They also sort of know sort of the strength of the ideas that are of interest to you, and that they can then make inferences from the co-authored paper. But only sending in co-authored papers where none of them you're the first author on, I think that that's, it's... Yeah. It's not going to be your strongest.
And I guess my caveat is that the co-author paper involved qualitative data that I designed the study,
right?
And I implemented the study and I collected the data for myself.
Okay.
And so it was like my two co-author chapters were substantively from the study that I created or whatever. So
I have a question. What? How do you find non-sociology jobs to apply to?
One more on the papers. What did Chelsea say about, did they only require publications?
No.
Chelsea, could you repeat what you said about whether you only required publications or just general writing samples?
So we don't ask for writing samples, we ask for publications, and those can be things that are submitted or being prepared for submission, but they need to be in the organization of a journal article and close to preparation for submission. And we didn't have any applications that at least one of the writing samples wasn't a publication, like a published paper. So that's the way that we frame that, is not asking for writing samples. We don't want to see dissertation chapters. We want to see published journal articles.
Great, thanks. Do you want
to? Yeah, the question was, how do you find non-sociology jobs to apply to?
So I met with Rand. Rand was at ASA. It depends on what kind of non-academic job you want to do. The policy research centers, the Mathematica, Rand, AIR, like those big ones. You know, you just go to the website and look for what positions they have available.
Looking outside of
in education.
But if you want more academic jobs that are outside of sociology departments, some of them will come through the ASA job list. So some of the public policy jobs, some of the ed school jobs will come through those ways. Some of the ones that I've had interviews at schools of education before, and those were through actually word of mouth. I heard about those postings. Some of it comes through just general listservs that you're on. So if you have interdisciplinary affiliations, then those will, I mean, that helps, right? So that if you have, the PAA, the population organization, will have its own set of job postings that will come through there that may not only be sociology postings, they will be more policy or more interdisciplinary postings that will show up along those lines. I know when I was looking on the Chronicle and just having broader search terms, mm-hmm. like if I knew I wanted to look at schools of education, I would put the listings that were up on the Chronicle website. It's also a good, I mean, I think everyone should be a member of ASA the year they're on the market because of all the access to job listings, the job listings that get emailed directly to you, the employment service that's there. But there's also a similar argument for therefore expanding your other professional memberships to the types of fields that you think you would be interested, so that way you can get access to their similar types of job posting resources.
Herc has Chronicle and Herc are
the big ones.
The what? HERC?
Higher Ed something.
Research
Council? Yeah. Herc.
So there's those are big places for non-sociology jobs.
There's also Annabelle mentioned the rumor boards.
They also post.
But only stay on the wiki part of that. Don't go to the message boards
don't
because
do that.
They are garbage, mm-hmm. and people are terrible, But like, stay on.
I'm terrified. What is it?
Don't Google
sociology rumor board.
There's a job market rumors, and they'll have a wiki of the
positions that are out
and the kind of rumors. It can be a good resource in terms of listing the jobs that are there.
But they tend to be very social. There's a political science one.
There's a few others. A communication one.
Right. Mm-hmm.
There's a site on Wikia that like it's a job rumor board and it has a lot of subdisciplines. And they're good just to see what the jobs are. A lot of the information is inaccurate.
The academic jobs wiki.
Yeah, that's the academic
has a lot
jobs wiki.
So that's the most comprehensive for postdocs.
Okay.
It's really good for postdocs. So it gives you all the postdocs and all the different disciplines, and then also the timeline, like what the application, when the application deadline is.
Yeah. The other thing
it's
is
academic.
If you,
it's like academic job wiki.
I think it's academic. Yeah, just like
academic
just Google
online.
Academic jobs wiki or something, and it's the site is the main site's wikia.com, which just hosts different wikis. And
it's terribly organized, but. It's not really, you can generally.
But other disciplines also have. So, like, geography has their big conference coming up soon, and they have a job site just like we do for ASA. So, if you're a member,
same with AJMC.
So, become members of all those organizations that you might be kind of related to, and then you get job postings from there as well.
There goes the price of the job. Right.
I've also seen a lot of jobs on
Twitter.
Does ASA Twitter?
And their lists get international postings?
Sometimes. And also, depending on your topic, like, I mean, if you have memberships in, like, the international sociology, like the RC, like, I'm a member of RC28, and they send out a lot, I mean, it's predominantly international job postings through there. So that's another resource that you can have.
Yeah. Oh, and that for the employment service, like, I just thought, like, if you sign up and you pay, then all of a sudden you're going to get job interviews, but you actually contact schools that have listings.
And
I was a little late with that, but yeah. So they put up their job postings, and there's like you use the ASA interface to send an email to them asking for an interview. Sometimes they'll contact you, but you can request interviews also.
So for academic jobs, are we dependent on ASA? And you said Chronicle?
The Chronicle of Higher Education.
There's a ton of jobs through there if you're looking for such jobs. You kind of don't need necessarily more than that.
Right.
That's the predominant places that most of them are posted to, So particularly if you're looking within the U.S. for jobs, like the majority of them are going to be posted there.
Yeah.
Also, community colleges? And
they're on there, too.
Yeah, they're also, they're usually on there. Yeah.
And where? Where's the there?
ASA.
International?
There are some.
In the direct interface of ASA, so you have to log on to the website.
So I think we are approaching the end of our time, and I think it would be a great idea to organize some mock interviews.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and also the other piece that Dave was talking about, which was the preparation, what you need, how to organize yourself before you actually get to the ASA meeting.
I feel like there's actually several, I mean, maybe not as much as, I feel like there are some resources on campus that actually talk about that a little bit, and that is something that the SOCH, that is the one thing that the SOCH job group actually somewhat prepares you for, did you think? Well, the other stuff of, but although they're a little bit hyped in terms of you need three articles to go in the job market.
Yeah.
I think there's meetings right before, you're on the market in two months, you should have three articles. The meetings are absolutely terrible.
Yeah. Well,
Robert's good, but Robert Vargas is really good about it.
But he only
has a lot of advice, but everything.
The quarter is
going. The meetings are a waste of time.